Good evening, everyone. It is September 3rd, and we are once again thrilled to have Kellermans at the Poison Pen. This time it is Jonathan Kellerman, dad from his beautiful home office, and Jesse Kellerman, dad three times and still with a young child. And I'm going to point out to you that Half Moon Bay, this wonderful book that we're going to talk about, I'm pretty sure that some of the writing is heavily influenced by Jesse's recent experiences with a new baby that won't sleep. Now, John, you're a pro because you've been through that several times, but it's been a long time for you.
Oh, yes, but you never forget.
The permanent trauma.
Yeah, no. My kids were good sleepers. Jesse was a great sleeper. He slept through the night at 7 weeks. 6 weeks, actually, 6 weeks. He was a dream baby, actually.
That was the last time I was a good sleeper.
Yeah, really.
It stopped at about age two.
He was a big baby. He was almost a 9-pound baby, so he slept quite easily.
So Half Moon Bay is the third novel in a collaboration between father and son, and features Deputy Coroner of Alameda County, Clay Edison, who I think is really an interesting character. And so is his profession, which may surprise you in the jurisdictional issues that come up. And part of the fun of this book is you get to go back and revisit Berkeley as it might have been in the 1970s through events that happened. And that meant a lot to me because I lived in California till I graduated from Stanford. And Berkeley was even then, guys, even then, an interesting and unusual place. And it always has been. So it's a lot of fun to revisit it with the two of you, and we'll go. But let me ask you this one question to start it off. How do you two refrain from killing each other by writing a book together? Because, I mean, father-son dynamics are not always perfect to begin with, and it must add all kinds of extra layers to be writing a book together.
Well, this is perfect. What are you talking about? Is it perfect?
We front-loaded all our conflict when Jesse was a teenager. No, it's true. And we never had really problems. I mean, Jesse, I think I'm being honest to say, Jesse and I get along great. We're very close. We really get along great. And I've been astonished that we've done all these books. I don't think we've exchanged a cross syllable, right? I mean, it's been very, very smooth. Unless I'm missing something. Right?
I second that. At the risk of sounding Pollyannish, I think we have an extremely well-suited set of skills. Our respective skill sets are complementary. We are unique writers as individuals, but when we come together, we're good at things that fit well together. I also think that the thing that is key for us is, we started collaborating. It was not on this series. We started with the Golem of Hollywood series. And when that kicked off, we did not know that this was going to become a long-term arrangement. We thought we would do this once, but then there was demand for more. So we've now done it five times, and we're going to do it several more. I think at the outset, I made the conscious decision, and I think my dad did too, to recognize that the relationship is far more important than the professional collaboration. Or the professional collaboration will at some point cease. I mean, I don't know, maybe it'll go 50 years, but at some point it will cease. But our relationship as father and son, that's permanent. And so we always, I think, are coming to the table trying to find the other person's perspective, and with a great deal of mutual respect.
To me, it was like I used to play in a band. When you play in a band, there are ego issues, but the main thing is, are the other guys good? If you're playing with people with good chops, it really is fun. And the thing about Jesse, I know he's my son, I love him, I think he's the smartest guy I've ever met, he really is a great writer. So when you're collaborating with a great writer, it just makes life so much easier. The only other person I've collaborated with is Faye, who's a great writer. And when we did a couple of books also, we had very smooth sailing. We really, I pride myself on being a guy who gets along with people. Back when I was a psychologist at Children's Hospital, I had a staff of 12 people. And all the psychologists on my staff 40 years later are still my friends. So, I mean, getting along with people is a big thing to me, but it hasn't been a challenge. I mean, it's been going smoothly. This is a strange year, so other things have been stressful, but the writing itself has been fine.
No, the writing is a refuge during the chaos.
Yeah.
Well, I asked the question in part because Jesse is an award-winning playwright as well as a novelist, and John has been a professional in psychology and psychiatry for forever, as his best-selling Alex Delaware series reveals. So you do have different skill sets. I always find it fascinating that, you know, as a playwright, you turn novelist so easily, Jesse, because you wrote some wonderful books on your own, as well as with your dad.
Yeah. Well, you know, Stephen King said it. He said, he read one of our books and he said, I know your voice, I know Jesse's voice. You have created a new voice. I thought, what a wonderful, sweet thing to say. So it's not my book, it's not Jesse's book, but we're both in there. And we have managed to find a hybrid voice. I think Jesse's background as a playwright and a director and an actor made it easier because he was used to collaborating. Yep. Theater is a collaborative endeavor, and Jesse enjoyed that. I collaborated with people as a psychologist and running a program for 4,000 patients with cancer. So we both had experience collaborating and getting along, and I think we didn't come into it with these massive ego cancer.
So. There's something very comforting about the fact that I have a partner who's written, you know, 40 books and has this endless this bottomless well of creativity. You know, there are moments when I get, I won't say stuck because I don't know that I've ever truly experienced writer's block in the sense that I feel out of ideas, but when I'm having trouble sort of finding the right way into a scene, when I'm having trouble figuring out, okay, where does this plot point go? To be able to call my dad and say, let's talk this through is tremendously comforting. So if anything, it's less stressful than writing a book on your own because you have backup.
You know, Faye said the same thing when I wrote with her. She said, this is great. If there's something that's giving me problems, I just shunt it over to you, and vice versa.
You deal with it.
You deal with it, you know.
I love it. So who came up with the concept of a deputy coroner? And can you tell us a little bit about what a deputy coroner does? Because it's an unusual role.
Well, it's very strange because I initially came up with a different concept of the coroner's investigator because I was dealing with LA. And in LA, there are coroner's investigators. And what they do is they say when you have a death, the case belongs to the cops, but the body belongs to the coroner. So the cops don't touch the body until the coroner clears it. Now, unlike movies, unless it's a celebrity, the pathologist, the doctor doesn't come out. They send these CIs, coroner's investigators. Often they're ex-cops, ex-nurses, social workers, and I thought, how fascinating. No one's ever done a book about these people. So then we decided to do it in Berkeley. And what did we learn, Jess?
Well, we learned that the system is slightly different over here.
Totally different.
Up here, the coroner's is a wing of the sheriff's. The sheriff is the coroner. And so all the coroner's investigators in Alameda County are peace officers. They're all sheriffs. So they all have a background in law enforcement. I mean, they're law enforcement officers. As well as they're trained to perform these specific duties. Up here anyway, it's what's interesting about death investigation, it really varies dramatically from place to place, from county to county. Around here in Alameda, which is in Alameda County, which is where we set the action in the East Bay, their jobs are threefold, really. The first is, as my dad said, it's care of the physical body of the person who has died. And we're not only talking about victims of homicides. Homicides are actually a small portion of what they do. They handle anybody whose death is unusual and requires investigation. So they appear at the scene of a death. It could be an obvious evident homicide where you got a guy with a knife sticking out of him or you have bullet holes, but also suicides, accidents, or situations where it's just not clear what happened. Their job is to show up and take custody of the body, as well as all the possessions that are on the body. A secondary job they have is to secure the decedent's property, meaning anything valuable in their house. They're the ones who put the seal on the door, do not come in. And most of the time, they're not protecting that much, but in cases where there are large estates, it's, you know, it's their job to make sure nobody comes in and steals stuff. Particularly, my contact in the coroners here has told me a ton about this. It's particularly important. They're very concerned that people don't break in and steal medication and guns. Those are the two things that they always take from somebody's house, because those are the things that if they get out can kill another person. And so they confiscate, or not confiscate, they take custody of all medication and guns, as well as things of obvious value, jewelry and things of that nature. So that's job number two. And job number three is they're the ones who are charged with contact, with finding, locating and contacting and informing the next of kin. Which is sometimes more complicated than it sounds, because with coroner's cases, all the coroners say, I don't want to be a coroner's case. A lot of times coroner's cases are people who are indigent, people who are in unusual, you know, very dire circumstances, people who are homeless. And so finding next of kin is not necessarily, a snap your fingers kind of thing. It requires some tracking down. And they're the ones who are, if the next of kin are local, they go in person and pay a visit and inform them that their loved one has died. And they're supposed to stay on site with the next of kin until somebody else can arrive, either family, friends, clergy, somebody who can make sure that that person who's just been given horrible news is going to be safe, emotionally safe, and they're not going to do something to harm themselves. So they have this strange duality to their personalities. On the one hand, they're investigators, they're cops, they're looking for the truth. And on the other hand, they have the sort of a role of counselor to people who are bereaved. Oh, sorry, there's one more important aspect of the job which I left out, which is that once the body comes in and the autopsy is performed, not by the coroner's investigators, it's performed by a physician, the pathologist. That's the person who does the autopsy. But then the coroner's investigators take the findings of the autopsy along with all the other findings from the scene, and they rule on what's called the manner of death, which is not the cause of death. So the cause of death is, what is the physical thing that killed you? So if I shoot somebody in the head, the cause of death is, you know, a bullet wound to their head and cerebral trauma and all that stuff. The manner of death is a homicide, and there are five manners of death: homicide, suicide, accident, natural or undetermined. And that has legal ramifications, as you can imagine, both for investigative purposes, for insurance purposes, et cetera, et cetera. It's their job to issue that ruling. So that's what they do. And so it's a job that brings them, and it brings our character, Clay, into a wide variety of situations.
He has to do a death notice, at least one in this book, which I found fascinating because I'm used to police, you know, doing it and bringing in social workers.
And but they the hate other it. Thing,
yeah, the other thing I thought was interesting is that if nobody can claim the body, if there is no person who's going to take responsibility for funeral, burial services, then it goes to cremation. Is that a relatively new thing? Is that
no.
a I mean? LA's
been doing it for decades. They have this pyre. They used to bury people. Now they just burn them. And
it used to be the potter's field, right? They don't do that anymore. They actually cremate, both for logistical reasons and cost reasons. But I will say that they try really hard to avoid that. They try really hard to find somebody. And even when somebody is cremated, they try really hard to repatriate, so to speak, the cremains to the next of kin. Going so far as, you know, one coroner I spoke to actually flew to Sweden to return an urn of ashes to somebody. They see this as really is almost like a calling. A lot of them, they're different from typical cops. You know, they're cops. They're still cops, you know, with all that entails. But a lot of them are, they see themselves very, very, very much as servants of the public, in the most people in their most trying times.
I raised the question in part because as forever 70-year crime reader and reading a lot of historical crime, the whole idea of, you know, exhuming a body when, you know, years later it's thought that maybe a crime occurred goes out the window if you have in fact cremated the body. So yeah. I thought it takes away one possible plot line, you know, if the body is gone.
I don't think they would do that unless, if there's any sort of doubt.
You know? I understand. Yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes there isn't any doubt. Sometimes it's like a perfect crime, you know.
And that's a good plot line. I'm going to use that.
I'm going to write that down.
There we go.
They have, right. when you go to the moor, what's shocking is how little space they have. There's just not that much room there. I mean, the freezers that they have are packed, and sadly, and you know, you can't keep everything for. They keep, you know, as typically, you know, this is not just Alameda, but they keep tissue samples. They keep anything that they think could be germane to the solution of a crime at some point. But you know, at some point, they run out of space, and they got to do something.
Morgues are strange places. The first time I saw a morgue, I was 15. I was in boarding school, and one of my classmates was applying to college. And you know, they assign an alumnus, and the alumnus they assigned to him was a county coroner in Baltimore. And he said, "Want to come with me, John?" I was 15 years old. I was a junior in high school. We went out to Chesapeake Bay, just walked into the morgue. First thing I saw were 5 dead bodies, including a child on a slab, people going to vending machines, eating food, eating candy bars. I was 15 years old. Nobody paid attention to me. It was the strangest thing. It really made a big impression. But I guess I figure if he could handle that interview, he was a good candidate to go to NYU. So, very, very, very good. And I've been to the Faye and I've been to the morgue, or as they really call it, the crypt, in Los Angeles on Mission Road. But in fact, I took some courses over at the med school at USC, and that's right near there. And I used to notice these guys hanging around the morgue, like around the corner. And there was a mortician school right down the block. So
what is the instigating incident of this particular book? How do you kick off the plot line?
Well, because we believe in value. It's not one, but 2 cold cases. Right. Are they related or not? You know.
Yeah. The very first incident that kicks off this book is the imagined demolition of a park in Berkeley called People's Park. Some of you probably have heard of People's Park. It's a bit of a cultural landmark around here, and I think beyond. It's the place where it was a hotbed of activity during the free speech movement and all that stuff, all that foment that was taking place in the late 60s, early 70s in Berkeley. It is this 2-acre patch of land sort of near the university that was originally owned by the University of California, Berkeley. They knocked down all these houses with the intention of putting up a dorm there, but it just sat and it became this muddy parking lot. And at some point, a group of people converged on it and said, we're claiming this in the name of the people. And even though they didn't legally own the land, UC still owns the land. It has always owned the land. It has turned into this sort of epicenter for, the people, a place for the people to come and express themselves and use their right to free speech. So at one point, I'm not sure if it was ever like a beautiful place, but it's at present, as a resident of Berkeley, I can say it's become a pretty degraded spot. And so to a certain extent, the course of history that's taken place there is representative of a lot of things that have happened around here over the last 50 years, and a lot of sort of ideas that have curdled over the last half century. So a couple years ago, in reality, not in our book, the university announced for like the 15th time, we're gonna knock this stuff down, we're gonna put up a dorm. They've been trying to do this for 60 years. And of course, everybody's going bananas and there's hearings. So, but this book opens on the day that the bulldozers actually roll into People's Park. So they're sort of tearing up the turf, and there's, as you can imagine, people are upset, people are protesting, there's counter-protesters, the real Berkeley scene. And as they are ripping up the free speech stage, they discover something that should not be there. They discover human remains. And that is what triggers this story, which, as my dad said, is really 2 stories.
So did you decide at the outset that you would have 2 for extra value, or did it just sort of develop?
No, because we outline before we write, so we know where we're going. I mean, we both outline, and we outline together. Even before the book starts, we spend a lot of time talking to you. We live in different cities, but I'll fly up there, well, in the old days, I would fly up there, he would fly down here, and we would talk, but we knew where we were going. We
thought my dad said, I remember when we were starting to talk about the structure of this book, he said, you know, I'm really interested in stories where you start going in one direction and it takes a very, very hard unexpected turn. And so that was sort of like the germ of causing this story to fork and become two separate narratives.
Yeah. It's all about surprise.
Yeah.
It is about surprise, but it seemed to me that a lot of the book is powered by people making really bad choices.
Oh yeah. Well, that's a crime novel. That's what it's all about. That's crime. People making bad choices. You know, I mean, there are innocent victims, of course, but at some level, if you're dealing with crime, somebody's making a very bad choice.
I think one thing that's important to us, though, you know, obviously they're making a lot of terrible decisions made in this book, but I'm always thinking, and I think my dad is always thinking, why would that seem like the right decision to the person at the time? Even though in retrospect, it's clearly a terrible thing. And sometimes the answer can be as simple as, you know, if you're talking about somebody who really just doesn't have any impulse control, people with bad impulse, you know, but there are other instances, and I think this book is actually that of where the context of what is happening makes something seem like the correct decision at the time, but it compounds and becomes something terrible. You know, this is the kind of structures you get in books like A Simple Plan, you know, where like things, it's like this step one sounds really, really logical, and it leads to step two, which also sounds logical, but by the time you're at step 50, the results are utterly catastrophic. And that's interesting because it takes people as humans, not as monsters.
Exactly. Well, you have a couple of monsters in the book, but
they're monsters. You gotta have a few.
Right.
Yeah. But you know, there are monsters and there are also people in the book who just are unlucky. Yeah. You know, their family situation, they've been victimized. I always try in my novels and the books that Jesse and I write together to understand everybody as much as I can, to understand everybody.
Well, you certainly have a wide variety of characters. I mean, one of the things, it's a big tapestry. You have old people, you have babies, you know, you have teenagers who always seem to be the people making the most unfortunate choices.
Because their frontal lobes aren't developed. You know?
Yeah. But the other thing I thought was fascinating in the book, and you have a great line, I don't know if I can find it to quote it again, but when you talk about the erosion of privacy, how it's snuck up upon us and all. And then you create an investigation for Clay where the digital age can't really come into play because in the 70s, the records that he needs to access are the old, you know, pencil and paper and, you know, filed away thing. And I thought it was great that you interplayed those two things, you know, the old school investigation as opposed to, you know, the modern way where you just like look stuff up.
We do, but the other thing is that even with technology, you know, every other show, DNA, all this forensic stuff, great stuff. I mean, it's made a big difference. Cops love it. A lot of high tech, but most homicides are still solved by just perseverance. Cops just persevering, talking to lots of people. And I think forensics account for solution in maybe 10% of homicides. So it's a lot more sexy to look at technology, but the human element, I think, is what interests us.
When you go back and look at old case files, as we have done, it's shocking what is not there. You know, I'm always very interested in how institutions preserve their records. And because it says a lot about like what they prioritize, right? You know, like what do we deem worth preserving? And some institutions try to collect every scrap and, you know, some edit history to be more favorable to them. And, you know, particularly when you're dealing with cold cases, the question is always, what is not here? What did not make it into the file? Which is a lot, because as my dad just said, crimes are committed by people, and people are motivated by desires and drives and emotion and greed and things. And those are things that are difficult to capture in a piece of paper. They're also difficult to capture in the digital age. As my dad said, there's still a lot of detective work that is taking place between the bytes, right? Because as we know, the selves that we document on the internet are not accurate depictions of ourselves, right? They're our best, they're the curated version of ourselves.
I really love what you did with the fire department. I thought I'd never even considered both the public face and the PR effect of the fire department, and how in general everybody's happy to see firemen where they may not be happy to see other public servants.
Totally.
I had firefighters and police officers as patients when I was in practice, and firefighters were just like the really mellow version. There was a commonality, but every single one was a really nice guy because they're out saving lives, and they generally, except in extreme situations, don't have to deal with the unpleasantness that police have to deal with.
Right, right. Yeah, no, everybody is always relieved to see the fire department show up. Nobody's like, except maybe the arsonist.
Yeah, the pyromaniac.
Everybody greets the firefighters. I spoke to a friend who's an Oakland firefighter, and he told me this. He said they've been in situations where there's literally gunfire coming across the street, and they will stop so that a fire truck can go through. He's had that happen to him.
Wow.
Well, there is a fire. You won't be surprised to learn, those of you watching it, there is a fire in the book, which is why we're talking about firemen. Yeah. But there's also the FBI in the book, and I did think, did you, either one of you, actually know an FBI agent who behaved like the guy that was always covering his ass instead of actually doing anything?
Well, you know, we can't say.
Well,
I know a lot of FBI agents. They're all kinds of, I know some lovely guys. When I wrote the Butcher's Theater, there was a FBI agent who I met. She used to show up at signings, and she said, "You scared the hell out of me with that book." I said, "If I can scare a serial killer profiler FBI agent, I did a good job on that book." But they're all kinds. But Jesse has contacts. He has a lot of contacts, and so do I.
FBI, I've dealt a fair amount with the FBI in the course of doing research, both person to person as well as dealing with the FBI archives. I have a lot of documents from the FBI archives for a never-ending project that I'm working on. It's like everybody. There's good ones, there's bad ones. For the most part, they tend to be bright. They're pretty bright on the whole. And they tend to be, there's this weird mix that I've encountered of like eagerness to tell their story as well as protectiveness of not wanting to get exposed, which is different in my experience from somebody like at the CIA. They just won't talk to you at all. The FBI is they're a more open, on the whole, they're a more open organization, and they're more willing to talk to people like us.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that the FBI agent was a bad actor, but you have the FBI guy, and then you also have one of the detectives, one of the policemen, and they're both just lazy to a great degree. They don't want to exert themselves, and I thought that was interesting too. What if you get a guy in a job that really isn't that engaged with his job? You know, he just kind of wants to walk through his day, do the motions. He's not evil, he's not corrupt, he's just lazy.
I think that's pretty common. I really do. Maybe I'm being a snob, but I think a lot of people just do their job and spend their time and get their pension and retire. But ones who are driven are really great, you know.
I think we have, there's balance in this book. We have the lazy guys and we have the guys. Right. I mean, Clay is unusually driven, right? Clay is would be atypical in almost any job in the sense that he's totally relentless. He's like a bulldog with the truth. But there's the whole spectrum, and he has sort of assembled around him in this series, and also as we go forward, this cast of secondary characters who are people he can trust and people he has worked with more than one time, and they make multiple cameo appearances. So there's a Berkeley cop, for example, named Nate Schickman, who has appeared in all three books. There's an Oakland detective, Delilah Nwoda, who's appeared in book two and book three, makes an appearance in the book that we're working on right now. You know, because I think cops, like everybody, it's like any office, right? You figure out who the good people are. You figure out who's gonna give you the short end of the stick and who's gonna be helpful.
And in fairness to these guys who come across a little bit indolent, you're dealing with old cases and they're just past it. They might have been more enthusiastic at the time they solved it, but they don't want to be confronted with their failures.
Yeah.
It's very unpleasant.
Yeah.
So I think that's an excellent point. Right. And so you've also had to address an issue that comes up quite often in crime fiction, which is if you give your lead investigator, your primary character, a family and a child, then how do you deal with not only questions about whether you can risk yourself and therefore harm your family, but who's going to watch the baby while his wife is at work and Clay is there? You have to give Clay both family and friends in order for them to be passing the baby around, because he can't really take her to the crime scenes in any great safety.
Well, there's a choice to be made when picking a protagonist. I kind of avoided it with Delaware because he doesn't have any kids.
Right.
But Faye's wonderful novels are full of domestic life, and other people have. And we just chose to do it this way. It's a little more challenging, but more realistic. Because let's face it, most people do have families.
And
every time a cop leaves, his wife has got to wonder, is he coming back? So it's a reality. It's a reality.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's definitely... we're walking a line here, you know, with what he can reasonably do, and that's something that weighs quite heavily on him, and it's something that we're gonna, you know, we plan to develop as the series goes on. How does he figure this out? I mean, as my dad said, cops have families. We have families. We know how much of our mental energy and emotional energy and our time is occupied by our families, and I think. I have the utmost respect for those series characters who you know, where the authors made a choice to make them sort of the roving. You know, I love Lee Child. I love Reacher. He's a great character. He's made those choices in order to be able to move him around from spot to spot, and without you questioning, you know, if he had a wife and kids, you think this guy's an asshole because he's walked out on them. He's doing irresponsible things. But the fact of the matter is people who do dangerous things still have families. And so, you know, that tension is something that we felt we could use. That gives it great emotional weight.
It makes him a full character.
Yeah. It does. I really like the scene with Clay and his brother, who has a complicated history. And yet in a desperate moment, Clay calls upon him for childcare, realizing that his wife won't be happy with this solution, but you know.
Not your ideal babysitter. Luke is not your ideal babysitter.
No.
And Luke will come to play in the next book in an even greater way.
Yeah. I like Luke. I thought he was really an interesting character.
He is an interesting character.
Right.
Yes. So just to sum up, we have two plots. One involves starts with unearthing a bundle of bones in the People's Park, and that's a cold case. And then the other comes to Clay, and it's somebody who wants to find a missing relative. He's not even sure if she exists or ever existed, doesn't even know her name, but has a feeling that somehow she's out there, and he has let it be an obsession. And so, you know, can Clay help him with that? And those are the two plot lines that I think play so well together. Patrick has appeared, so let me just check with him and see if we have any questions or we can carry on.
Great. Thanks. Great.
There are a few questions. Let me see if I can kind of put a few of them together here for you.
They're often similar questions.
There are some similar ones.
Right.
I mean, there's the inevitable question about when is the next Alex Delaware book coming out?
February. It's called Serpentine.
Ah.
It's finished.
Oh, come on. That's not enough answer, John.
I'm sorry?
That's not enough answer. They want to know just a hint of what it might be about.
Well, it's called Serpentine, so it twists and turns in many, many ways. It's also about a very wealthy young woman whose mother was murdered. When she was a toddler, and she has no memory of her, and she'd like to stir up an investigation as to what happened to her mother she never knew. That's how it starts, but it goes all kinds of different places.
All right.
And I'm working on another one. And we're working on another clay. So we're doing our best for God, country, and publishing.
Okay, so Jesse, you're working with John on the next Clay Edison novel. Are you doing any project of your own?
I have,
so to speak.
Well, I have a number of side projects. The clay books are very, very absorbing. They take a lot of time and energy. But I have a number of side projects that I've just been sort of keeping warm for some time. One is a graphic novel I'm doing in collaboration with a friend of mine. One is this novel about my great aunt, my father's Aunt Molly, that I've been researching for like a decade. It's taken a really long time because Freedom of Information Act requests move extremely slowly. That was in large part why I've had to deal with the FBI so much, because my father's aunt Molly was a dyed-in-the-wool communist and had an enormous FBI file. So I've been working on sort of piecing her life together and writing something out of that. Other projects not worth mentioning. The clays take up like 95% of my attention.
I have a couple of questions here, which are just basically about how did you decide to collaborate together in the first place? And you've addressed that a little bit, but
it was by accident, really. I had gotten the notion for the first Golem book, Golem of Hollywood. And I wrote about 80 to 100 pages of it. And I had two other books that I was writing, as well as some other projects. And it was overwhelming. And I was going to put it aside because I knew it was going to be a huge book and a complex book. And Jesse and his family happened to be down visiting us, which we like when that happens, with his wonderful wife and three amazing kids. And I was talking to him about it. I said, I need some help on this. And he got into it, and then we decided to give it a try. And that's how it started. And we had so much fun. We did another Golem book. And then we decided to switch to the Clay series. And now we're on the third one of those. So it just was kind of an organic thing. And, it's fun. Graham Greene said that when a writer turns 60, there's only two reasons to write: fun and money. I just turned 71, so I've definitely been for 10 years. If it's not fun, I don't want to do it at this point.
So Jesse, is that your memory of this whole collaboration?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, I'll add one wrinkle, which is that my dad, my parents went to Prague, and my dad had the idea for this book, the book that would become the Golem of Hollywood. And as he said, he wrote a good chunk of it, he brought it back, and he was just sort of like, I don't know, this doesn't seem, it was out of his usual, wheelhouse, but he showed it to me, and I just thought it was so great, and I was really encouraging him to work on it. And I'll say one thing, that which is, it was really cute to see my dad, who's this really accomplished guy, who's like a lion in his field, sort of shyly giving me this management, be like, I don't know what about this. But I was so taken with it. I said, you really got to do this. And he said, I can't, I don't have enough energy. And he said, well, why don't you just write it? And I said, well, I'm not just going to write your book. And we just sort of, went back and forth. And eventually we said, well, let's try doing it together. But there was no plan of attack. It was not organized. We didn't know if we could sell it. We didn't know if we could finish it. We didn't know what it was going to become. We didn't know how we were going to work together. That was utterly improvised. At this point, having done a number of books, we have a system worked out, and it's much more streamlined. But it was really by the seat of our pants with that first book.
I think some of the best experiences in life are, I won't say serendipitous, but organic, in the sense that I'm just not a big planner. I'm kind of experiential, and I just like to put myself in interesting places and see what develops. It may sound strange to someone who got a PhD, so there was definitely planning there, but I never applied for a job in my life. I just kept, people said, hey, you want to do this? I said, okay, it sounds good, so I'll do that job. And they gave me a job at Children's, and I drifted into something else. That's the way I live. I tell my son, I am not a mature person.
I'm going to add up. Right. In case any of you missed the opening, any of you watching it, I'm going to add that having read the Clay Edison books, well, I've read all of all of their collaborations. It really is a third voice. When you read Half Moon Bay, it is not Jonathan's voice or Jesse's voice, both of which I know, but it's a third person. It's a brand new voice and really fascinating.
Yeah. No, we're really happy about that.
Me too.
Actually, Jesse, I have a question for you, which is I've seen you here at the Poison Pen with both of your parents and Eliza once, I think, was here. Is that right, Eliza? I was. Mm-hmm. And I just have a question. It seems like it's pretty amazing to watch the whole family in action and the dynamic that takes place. And I couldn't help myself thinking, wow, what a magical childhood that you all must have had. You know, I mean, just surrounded by this artistic, wonderful environment. True?
Oh, yeah. It was just rainbows and unicorns. So I had a terrific childhood. It was flawless. I was not conscious. This is might sound unbelievable, but I had a notion of what my parents did professionally. So one thing that's important to remember is that when I was really little, my dad was not a full-time novelist. He was a psychologist. So I knew him as a guy who would put on a jacket and tie and go to work and then come home in the evening, and I would greet him by smashing into him. His transition into becoming a full-time novelist happened over like 7-8 years, right? You were still seeing patients for a long time. So even once that happened, I had an idea of what they were doing professionally, but I did not have a sense of sort of who they were in that world, like what their stature was in the quorum world. And that was because I, like most kids, was totally uninterested in my parents' interior lives, especially as I became a teenager, right? Like there's nothing less interesting than what your parents are thinking about. And so I was able to sort of like, shield myself from any possible goodwill or sympathy for what they were going through. I was just an asshole teenager. The one thing that was extremely, extremely important and that I absorbed really osmotically just by being in the house was that I saw what my parents did and I saw that they treated it as a job. They were professionals. They were not the kinds of writers who came downstairs in sweatpants, unshaven, and then proceeded to wait for the muse to show up and knock on the door. They were extremely organized. For all my dad says about, not being someone who plans, he is an extremely organized thinker and he outlines and he edits and he's very meticulous in what he does. I think what he's referring to, which I feel as well, is that creatively you have to be sort of like open and tuned to the universe and receptive when it gives you these ideas and when spontaneous creativity visits you. You have to be tuned to that wavelength. But the way they treated it as a job and the way they wrote a book one page at a time that adds up over time to become 400 pages, that was extreme. That was vital in my learning how to structure my writing life.
And I think it also helped that when Jesse was interested in becoming a writer, we didn't poo-poo it.
Right.
But our family, and I think Faye gets a lot of the credit, we had an assistant once who said, Faye, you're the first boss I've ever had who cooks. She was such a down-to-earth mother. Here she's writing bestsellers, she's written 30, 40 books, and the kids wouldn't have known it. I mean, she was just a great mom, and she kept things very, very level, which she still does. And the thing is, we have Jesse, who's a writer, and Eliza writes, but we also have two other daughters, Rachel and Lonnie, and they're psychologists, which is interesting. One is a very well-regarded pediatric psychologist specializing in GI disorders. The other one has a private practice for adults in Beverly Hills, very successful women. And so it wasn't all about writing. I would say we were a child-oriented family. Faye and I were really devoted to our kids. And now what's really cool is we have 8 grandkids with a 9th coming. And so they're just a great bunch. No one's going to believe this. We had our Sturm und Drang. We had our conflicts. We had our screaming fits. But since the kids have gotten married and we'll get together, there's 18 or 19 of us, we really do get along. It's kind of miraculous. And the grandkids kind of like each other and the spouses like each other. So far, so good. can't take any credit, but you know.
I'll tell you two things. Yeah. Which is that after we had our first child, our first son was born, I called my dad. It was like about a week after, a few days after he came home from the hospital, I called my dad and I said, "Dad, I'm so sorry for everything I've ever done to you."
And your that sister did it too. Your sister did it too spontaneously.
Yeah, because
when she had her first. Now you understand.
But I'll also say that, so you know, my kids are my kids are still fairly young. We have an almost 11-year-old. We have a 4-year-old, and we have a 2-year-old. And they are not interested or aware of what I do. The 11-year-old knows, obviously knows in an objective sense. But my other kids, they only see me when I come out of the office, and I don't talk about my writing at the dinner table. That's not something that I discuss. First of all, it's usually boring. It's private. I don't want to I'd rather hear about what they're doing. So if you ask my son, I only emerge from my office, you know, to take a break from my writing. And so if you ask my 2-year-old son, what does daddy do? What's daddy's job? His answer is exercise. He says exercise because that's the only time he sees me emerge from the office is to go out to my garage and lift weights. So that's what he thinks I do. That's what he thinks my job. Maybe I wish, you know, wish it was my job, but he's not. They're not aware of me as a writer in any real sense.
You know, there was no pretentiousness. It's not like in the movies. It's a great job, but it's a job. And Faye and I both came from other fields. We had doctorates in other fields in healthcare. And we were just into really trying to raise good, unspoiled kids. And we succeeded, I'm very happy to say.
Yes, you did. I've been very lucky to spend time with you. And I do think that you are very much a family-oriented, you know, very family-oriented, child-oriented and all. And there's so much goodwill. In fact, I really came to know you, John, through Jesse, because I felt that, you know, Jesse made me see what a really great parent you are.
Thank you very much. Well, I give Faye the credit, really, because she, I have to admit, if I was in charge, I probably would have hired someone to drive them to school. But she drove them to school. She's just a Midwestern girl and no BS, you know.
Okay, well, I think that pretty much wraps things up. Anything else over there, Patrick? No, this has been wonderful. The great thing about Zoom is we get a chance to do some things that might be more difficult to work out. So I'll be in touch with Faye because I know she has a book coming out in October. So maybe you and Faye can come back and we'll visit. And then I'll catch up with you in February. It'd be even more wonderful if you're in Jerusalem and we could actually do an event from there.
Yeah, because we just bought an apartment there and we can't get there. So, you know.
I know. But
hopefully,
you know,
in a few months.
Yeah, well, Zoom is really international. I've been in Sweden and Iceland and Australia and all over talking to authors.
Well, you know, the Jerusalem apartment, it's the stuff was just shipped and they're bringing it over to the apartment and Faye's going to sit and Zoom with the project manager, where to put rugs, where to put furniture, all going to be done. Amazing. Amazing.
Well, it is absolutely true. Anyway, guys, it's really been a pleasure. Half Moon Bay, the one question I forgot to ask you, why is it called Half Moon Bay for people who don't know California geography?
You want to take that?
Well, so the Half Moon Bay is this beach town that's about 45 minutes south of San Francisco, and it plays. I'll keep it, you know, no spoilers. It plays a role in the book, personally, and I wanted to work that locale into the book for two reasons. First of all, one thing we do in this series, we sort of move the spotlight all around the Bay Area. So you have scenes in Berkeley, scenes in Oakland, scenes in Marin, scenes, you know, all over the place. And that's interesting to me because it's a sort of, at least in the crime world, there's been some written about that, but not a lot happening, you know, in the contemporary Bay Area. So we get to sort of like do a best of by moving the scenes around. I also wanted to, as my dad, one of my dad's touchstone writers is Ross, the great Ross McDonald, and I've read a lot of Ross McDonald's well. And McDonald, there's an interesting thing that happens in his books where there's a lot of going up and down between Southern California and Northern California. And in fact, in one of the books, which is set in the 60s, he refers to Berkeley being totally crazy. So it was truly, this is pre People's Park. But he has a locale called Luna Bay that where several things take place, which is sort of like Santa Teresa is a thinly veiled version of Santa Barbara. Luna Bay is a thinly veiled version of Half Moon Bay. Although he also refers to the actual Half Moon Bay. So there's like these two realities in his books. So that was sort of my inside baseball reason for calling this book Half Moon Bay.
It was a very evocative title for me because Half Moon Bay was the scene of campus beer beach parties when I was a graduate. And wait, here's the ringer. We decided to have a hot dog roast right before finals of my junior year. And we cut sticks to roast the hot dogs on, and they were all poison oak. All of us were so ill, we couldn't take finals. We were in infirmary. It was an absolute, so Half Moon Bay is a very evocative title.
We've evoked it.
It's not so bad to have poison oak on the outside, but when it's also on your inside, because you ate it and you breathe it, I can't tell you how horrible it is. So, but anyway, that's me. thank you very much, guys. And I want to thank all of you who joined us tonight, and stay tuned for further adventures with the Kellermans.
Thank you, Barbara. And thank you, fans.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.